In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about alcohol and women. For a long time, until really fairly recently, alcoholism was considered to be mostly a men's disease. And perhaps not surprising, when you take a look at research, prevention efforts, and treatment, all of that was aimed at men, despite the fact that at least 25% of alcoholics are women. For women, the effects of alcohol on their body are different. One might argue that the various dimensions of alcoholism are different. And then when it comes to prevention and treatment, the approach needs to be different. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a journalist who's written a book on the subject. Her name is Devon Gerstled. She has written for publications including The New York Times, USA Today, Red Book, Glamour. She won an O. Henry Award for writing in 1991. She's taught courses in women's studies and creative writing at Middlebury College and is administrative director of the Breadloaf Writers Conference. The book we're talking about is titled Happy Hours, Alcohol in a Woman's Life, published by Cliff Street Books, which is a division of HarperCollins. As we talk this morning with our guest, questions, of course, are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief and just so that we can keep things moving along and include as many different people as possible. But certainly your questions, comments are welcome. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call. Well, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, David.
I have to admit that I have been having a hard time with your name, and if I maul it, you're just going to have to forgive me. Particularly your last name, I guess I'm not quite sure.
It's Devon Gerstled.
Gerstled, okay. Maybe I have a little touch of dyslexia. I keep wanting to say Gerstled.
You're not the only one.
Well, anyway, thank you very much for talking with us today.
I'm glad.
Maybe to begin, we might talk about the subject that you really start with in the book, where you talk about the difference in the effect of alcohol on men and women. I think we have this idea, or sort of people have this idea, that there's some relationship between the amount of alcohol you consume and body weight, and that your size has something to do with it. And indeed it does, but one of the things that you point out and people need to appreciate is that if you take a man and woman of equivalent size and give them the same amount of alcohol, the effects are going to be different. And it goes beyond this issue of how big you are. Women's bodies handle alcohol differently than men's bodies do.
That's really true. And in Happy Hours, what I do is I sort of posit a man and a woman, Pete and Lori, who are both 140 pounds, and talk about the effects on their bodies if they both, say, have four drinks a day, something like that. And it was really surprising to me in doing this research just how different the effects could be on men and on women. Some of them are. I think the thing that surprised me the most is that women are at risk for cirrhosis of the liver at as little as two drinks a day. So that's only one difference. Women do get a higher blood alcohol level with the same amount of drinks if they're the same weight. They have less of a particular enzyme that breaks down alcohol in the stomach lining, so that's part of the issue. They also have a higher percentage of body fat, so that alcohol is more concentrated in their body fluids. But they're more vulnerable to liver disease, to brain damage, heart muscle problems. All sorts of problems develop after fewer years of problem drinking for women. Mm.
And among other things, I guess there is some thinking that high levels of alcohol consumption might increase a woman's risk of breast cancer.
That's true. And some people have been mistakenly reassured on that count, because there was a study a few years ago that showed that with small levels of drinking, there was no increased risk for breast cancer, which is really good news, and women who are drinking moderately should feel reassured on that score. But that it's really important to remember that was for light and moderate drinking. There were not enough women drinking heavily in that study to rule out problems of breast cancer for them. And previous studies showed that a woman's risk of breast cancer increases by as much as 40% if she's drinking heavily, which is, you know, three, four drinks a day. Hmm. Actually, I should say heavy drinking is considered two drinks a day for a woman. But we know that the breast cancer risk goes way up at higher levels than that.
So we know that as far as women are concerned, the problems associated with using alcohol are greater than for men in equivalent amounts of alcohol. But then it also sounds as if it is easier for a woman to become alcohol dependent than it is for a man because of the same sort of thing.
Yeah, women become alcohol dependent more quickly after fewer years of drinking and with less alcohol in their systems. That's true.
Something else that you write about, and it certainly, I'm sure, complicates the way that we think about women and drinking, goes back to this fact that we do think of it as being a man's disease, and also the fact that our attitudes toward men and women who may have problems with alcohol are very different. And as much as we would say that alcohol dependence is a problem, I think we tend to cut men some slack on this. We sort of say, oh, well, that's a thing that guys do. And we're willing to be a little bit more forgiving, but certainly we're much more the sort of posture we take toward women who are heavy drinkers is much different.
I think you're touching on probably the most important difference between men and women's alcohol problems, because that issue of the shame that women feel when they become alcoholic is, it affects every aspect of their disease. It affects their motivation to get treatment. They're more likely to hide their drinking. They already may be drinking in part to get rid of feelings of shame, which are intensified by people's responses to them. It's true that we think, a man who drinks heavily doesn't necessarily think of himself as less of a man because he drinks heavily. There are a lot of really positive images of male drinking. So, we have the macho drunk. We have the poetic drunk who drinks heavily and goes home and writes brilliant poetry or brilliant novels. There are a lot of ways to drink heavily and still feel like a real man. But I can't think of any images of women in the movies or in our, in our national imagination or international imagination, actually, that has the female alcoholic being a figure of romance or interest. All of the images of women drinking are negative. That we have the idea of a drunken woman as being a whore, a slut. Terrible sexual stigma attached to female alcoholism. And also we think of her as being unnatural, especially if she has children. A man who doesn't come home from the bar to tuck his kids into bed, we don't like that if he doesn't see his kids after work. But if a woman doesn't see her kids after work because she's off at the bar drinking, we become much more judgmental and condemning. So, woman's role in society means that she's judged very much more harshly, and it affects every aspect of her drinking.
Mm. And I suppose that puts even greater pressure on a woman to keep her drinking hidden, and that might also explain how it is that people will say if they have someone close to them, they discover a woman who has an alcohol problem, that they can say with genuine surprise that they didn't know, even though this might have been something that had been going on for years.
That's really true, and I think it works in two different ways. I think sometimes women do feel so much shame that they hide their drinking and are very good at hiding it, but also the families are so reluctant to see an alcohol problem in a woman that even when it's staring them in the face, sometimes they don't see it. I interviewed one woman for Happy Hours who managed to hide her drinking from her husband for, I think it was 8 or 10 years. She was heavily drinking without his knowing it, and he was truly, truly astonished, even though all of the signs were right there in front of him all those years.
And that's to me, and I'm sure to a lot of people who would hear a story like that, that would astonish them. They would say, how could you? How could that possibly be that someone that close to you would be drinking heavily for that many years and that you wouldn't notice?
I was myself so astonished by it that I didn't believe it for a little while. But in talking to clinicians, I find out that it's not an unusual story.
And maybe one other point here. You know, we talked about the fact that it seems because of the way we think about alcohol, men and women, that it may be difficult for us to accept this idea of a woman alcoholic. That not only is that an issue for people who would be close to her in her life, but it's also an issue for any healthcare professional she might deal with. It seems to have been the case, maybe still at some. Somewhat the case for doctors and other people like that to be reluctant to diagnose alcohol in a woman, again, because they have this idea that, well, alcoholism is something that you see in men.
Well, I wish I could tell you that that had changed in recent years, but the most recent studies suggest that that has not changed, that doctors are still more likely to miss the alcohol dependence in a woman than they are in a man. And I have to say they're not so good at finding it in men either. There are a lot of problems in diagnosing alcoholism, partly because the people who become dependent on alcohol do become very good at hiding it. They want to protect their drinking habit because they're addicted to it, and they don't want to have it taken away. So, you know, they do make it hard for doctors, but there are ways for doctors to get around the denial of their patients and help them, you know, confront them at least with an alcohol problem. In women, they're more likely to diagnose depression and not know that the depression is coming from the alcohol problem. And especially interestingly, they're likely to miss an alcohol problem in a woman if she is affluent enough to have good insurance, interestingly, because again, it's the stereotypes we talk about. They are more likely to think of a bag lady as an alcoholic and not a middle-class woman with good insurance.
Our guest is Devon Jurseld. She's author of the book Happy Hours, Alcohol in a Woman's Life. It's published by Cliff Street Books, which is a division of HarperCollins. Questions are certainly welcome if you'd like to be a part of the conversation. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free life line, a good for anyone who's listening. And if it would be long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Sometimes I think, too, that the very term alcoholism and the various images that we attach to it make it a problematic and sometimes not a very useful term. And I think that that also makes it possible for people who are in denial about themselves or their family members to say, well, I'm not an alcoholic, or my wife, my sister, whoever it is not an alcoholic because of the way we think about what an alcoholic is. And I think that's not just that we think it's men and not women, but particularly I think when it comes to high-functioning alcoholics.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, David. And sometimes I try to train myself not to use the word alcoholic because, as you say, people have a specific image in their minds about what that is, and it's so negative that they won't apply it to themselves or their loved ones because it's just there's too much stigma attached to it. Doctors and health other kinds of health clinicians think in terms of alcohol abuse and alcohol dependence. And abuse is technically drinking too much or too often in spite of reasons not to. So let's say it causes health problems or you drink and drive or you're not able to fulfill your obligations at work or in relationships because of your drinking. If alcohol is interfering in your life in any way and you're still drinking, that's alcohol abuse. Alcohol dependence is all of those things, as well as an increased tolerance so that it takes you more alcohol to get high. If it takes a woman 3 drinks to feel high, she's probably been developing tolerance. That's part of it. Part of it is having withdrawal symptoms if you stop drinking, and part of it is difficulty cutting back, not being able to stop even when you want to. Not to say that alcoholics or people who are alcohol dependent can't stop for 2 weeks, even if they want to prove to themselves that they're not alcoholic. People will often do that successfully and then start drinking again. But someone who's alcohol dependent probably can't keep that up. They probably can't say, all right, I'm not going to drink any more than 2 beers a day and stick to that. They're more likely to have lots of reasons why they can on this special occasion of someone's wedding or on the sad occasion of someone's funeral or whatever it is, there will be a reason to drink more than those 2 beers over a stretch of time.
Maybe I should give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about your own experience, because indeed it was an experience that you had with your sister that put you intimately in touch with this issue, but then also led you as a journalist to want to explore it, particularly looking at the whole question of what kind of treatment is available for women, and how does treatment need to be different when you're talking about women as opposed to men.
Well, that's right. In my own experience, it was my sister's struggle with alcoholism that led me to the topic. About 4 years ago, she was in a really bad place. She'd been drinking chronically for many years. And I was worried that I was going to lose her sooner rather than later. So I thought I had developed ways of coping, of dealing with the problem and staying in touch with her, but not trying to control her, all the things I knew that I was supposed to do. But I panicked. I thought I was going to lose her. She was drinking so heavily at the time, and I'm happy to say now she's doing really well. She's been sober for quite a while now and much, much better. But at that time, I just was desperate to find out how other women had been helped and to learn as much as I could, partly just to deal with my own energy and frustration and pain on the topic. So I interviewed 40 women in recovery, and a lot of clinicians and therapists and researchers, scientists, and did a lot of reading to pull this book together.
I want to ask you about one thing in particular, and I think that people who have an alcoholic family member, they seek out various kinds of advice from various kinds of professionals about what they can do to persuade a person who is reluctant or resistant to have treatment. And I think often the advice that they're given is, well, what you have to do is cut yourself off from that person, to say to them, until you get on this, until you get yourself help, I'm not going to talk to you, I'm not going to call, I'm not going to see you, and that somehow only the threat of losing their family can push people to the point where they'll admit that they have a problem and that they go have help. And that seems to be really problematic. A lot of people, when they get that advice, are very unhappy about it. What do you think about that, and do people still hear that from professionals?
Well, I heard it myself. One night when I was really in a panic, again, you know, I thought I had was dealing with this all really well, and then I got a call from my sister and realized that her blood alcohol level was so high that, you know, she could die. And I called an AA hotline, and that's the advice I got. A fellow answered and said, you know, I've got to tell you, you've just got to tell your sister you'll never talk to her again unless she gets sober. And it really was very upsetting to me to hear that. I was sure, I mean, I never really gave it consideration. I knew that it was the wrong advice for me and for my sister. Now, this fellow had got sober specifically because his own mother had told him finally that she couldn't handle it. She couldn't see him anymore until he was sober. And it was what prompted him into recovery. So, I mean, it really does work for some people, and you know, and more to the point, some relatives or spouses or family members are really in a position where they're in a lot of pain, they're over-involved in the alcoholic's life, and the only healthy thing to do is to say, I can't handle this anymore, come and see me when you're sober. So, you know, that's sometimes the right way to go, but it's by no means universal advice, I mean, good advice for everybody. It was wrong for me and my sister. I'm sure that my consistent contact with her, I know she tells me that it was meaningful to her and gives her the support now that helps her have the courage to stay sober and do the work. Not only my support, but that's part of her life. I'm part of her life. And many of the women I interviewed told me of some person who stayed supportive and encouraging and didn't try to force them to stop drinking or try to control them, but kept contact. So I think your point's a good one, David, that, you know, any time there's sort of one-size-fits-all advice, you know you're in trouble because every situation is a little bit different. Everyone's capacities are a little bit different. I interviewed one woman for Happy Hours who had a couple of small children. This is an African-American woman with a couple of small children who was so alcoholic, so in such trouble, she was thinking of killing herself. Her sister showed up at her door, took her on the bus with her children to her own home in Minnesota, kept her in her apartment. She actually gave her baths. She did everything but spoon-feed her. She took care of her children, all without trying to get her to stop drinking or trying to manipulate her in any way. She just went off to work every day, came back, and every night this woman, Louise, that I interviewed, said she could hear her sister in the next room, in the bedroom, praying, "Please, God, help me, help my sister. Please, God, help me, help my sister." And, you know, many people, when they hear this story, would say, well, Louise's sister was enabling her to keep on drinking by giving her a place to stay and taking care of her children and bathing her and providing for her financially. But really what happened was that Louise had the time she needed to pull herself together and to decide that she wanted to get sober. So, you know, one day her sister came home, and there was Louise all dressed, ready to go out and look for an apartment of her own and to start her own recovery process. So I don't want to recommend that for families. I certainly myself could not have invited my sister into my home and taken care of her that way, and I don't think it would have been good for her. But I just do want to point out that there are so many different ways that people come to recovery, and it's really important when you go for help that you know the person you're going to help for is really listening to you and helping you with your particular situation.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, this idea that people who are heavy drinkers, they find lots of different reasons to stop. And I think maybe we've put too much emphasis on the idea of hitting bottom, the idea that the only thing that can persuade a person to stop is when they felt that they've lost everything, which could mean home, job, wife, children, husband, you know, everything. And I think that indeed may have been the story for some people, but probably should not give people the idea that that's what everybody's got to go through.
That's right. And really that model of hitting bottom was based on the experiences of middle-class white men who really already had lives that were successful, and really it was alcohol that caused them to lose their job or whatever, and they really did have to hit bottom before they could realize that they couldn't control their drinking. But for a lot of people, if you say, well, they haven't hit their bottom yet, well, their bottom is death. You know, so the idea of waiting for their bottom, for them to get help, it's just not possible. It's not practical. So it's true. We need to have new ways of well, we need to have a broader sense of the different kinds of people who are dependent on alcohol. And one of the thoughts I had while you were speaking is that one of the somewhat newer approaches is to realize that you can kind of raise the bottom for many people, so that you can in interventions with professionals, for instance, you can have the people who love the alcoholic and the boss of the alcoholic, et cetera, let them know how the alcohol is is affecting their lives. And, you know, sometimes it is helpful for a wife to say to a husband, or a husband to say to a wife, you know, I won't be able to tolerate it beyond this point. And anyway, there are a lot of different approaches, but certainly the idea of the bottom is one that's controversial and not right for everyone.
I should again introduce our guest here. We're a little bit past our midpoint. We're talking with Devon Gersild. She is the author of the book Happy Hours, Alcohol in a Woman's Life, published by Cliff Street Books, a division of HarperCollins. Our guest is a journalist. She's contributed essays and stories in different publications, including New York Times, USA Today, Red Book, and Glamour. She is administrative director of the Breadloaf Writers Conference and also has taught courses in both women's studies and creative writing at Middlebury College. Your questions, comments certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Going back to perhaps the differences between men and women and their experiences with alcohol. One of the things that is evident and I'm sure problematic is the fact that you mentioned here in the book that alcoholic women are more likely than alcoholic men to have a mental health disorder, particularly depression, although there can be other things like anxiety and eating disorders. And this seems to be something that sometimes is really difficult to untangle, whether depression led to the drinking or drinking led to depression. And I don't know, maybe in the final analysis, that really doesn't matter which way it goes. But it suggests that it's a much, that for women, the psychological aspects of this may be more complicated.
Yeah, it's true that women do have tend to have a more complicated mental health history than men who are alcohol dependent. They are more likely to be depressed as well. It's common among men as well. But more often, men become depressed, you know, after they've started their drinking, and women, they've often more often had the problem before they started drinking. So that does factor into recovery needs for sure. But there are other issues. Younger women, women under 30 who are alcohol dependent, and there are a number of those, growing number, 72% of them also have an eating disorder. And most strikingly, a very large percentage of alcohol-dependent women have been sexually abused in childhood. So this is, in some ways, the most striking finding that there is about women and alcoholism, and it has a massive effect on recovery needs. A woman who's been sexually abused and is also dependent on alcohol can't, you know, just focus on getting sober and then deal with her other problems later, which is the traditional model. She really needs help from the beginning with her sexual abuse, because very often, and many of the women I interviewed, in fact, started drinking when they started remembering the sexual abuse. Sometimes that was in teenage years. That's a very common time to start remembering childhood sexual abuse. Sometimes one woman I spoke with very recently started remembering, not that she had forgotten, but, you know, she had managed to push it out of her head until she was about 35 and then was having a lot of flashbacks and panic. And the drinking is a way sometimes for women to not remember, to become preoccupied, and sometimes just to stay in that alcoholic cycle where you're craving a drink or you're drunk or you're having withdrawal symptoms. It keeps you from dealing with the sexual abuse. So these women very often need all women's therapy groups. They need all women's AA meetings or women for sobriety meetings, whatever their support group is. Very often it needs to be all women for them to feel safe. So there are many different correlates of alcohol problems in women.
Mm-hmm. Well, it goes to the idea that, and maybe it's something that people will recognize, that it seems that a lot of people who are abusing alcohol are medicating themselves. And then the question becomes, well, why? I mean, what is it that they're trying to, what sort of pain are they trying to numb? And that here, based on the differences in experience between men and women, it's different. It's something of the same issue, maybe because it's involved in numbing pain, but it's the nature of it that's different.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. It could be self-medication for both men and women, and I think it often is. But as you say, it can be specifically sexual abuse. And for women, you know, it can be current domestic abuse as well. Women who were sexually abused in childhood are also more vulnerable to violence as adults.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's self-medication. Women are often, a really common theme among the women I interviewed for Happy Hours was drinking to take the place of a relationship, to make them feel, you know, better about a relationship that wasn't mutual and wasn't satisfying. And sometimes, you know, very often, in fact, to try to make themselves more acceptable within the relationships. So, for instance, I'm thinking of one woman in Happy Hours who was sort of jealous of her husband and angry at him because of his successful career, and she had chosen to stay home with the children, and she didn't think she should be feeling that way. She thought she had made this choice, and she should be happy as a mother, and she drank really because it made her angry feelings melt away. And when she was with her husband, she felt sort of warm and loving and all the things that she thought it was right for a woman to feel.
And that touches off a memory. Do I remember that somewhere in the book here, and I'm looking forward to not finding it, there's a line, something to the effect that for women, alcoholism is primarily about loneliness?
Well, yes. I'd say that the conviction that grew the most as I worked on Happy Hours and that I'm left with very strongly is how much alcoholism is about isolation.
Yeah, isolation.
Yeah, it for women. And that can be true. One woman I interviewed is a lawyer who really only drank socially, only with friends, and had a lot of friends. And you wouldn't have thought of her as an isolated person, but even she was emotionally really isolated. She said that she really thought she drank to say, I'm not what I look like. I'm not who you think I am. I don't have this. It looks like I have a perfect life, but I'm cut off. I'm lonely. And I'm a fraud. And that's just one example. Really, drinking often starts off to ease those feelings of being isolated and give you a kind of false sense of connection, because it does do that. And then ultimately it isolates you further. So that recovery is really about healing those broken connections to yourself, your own feelings, to your family, to your community, to your spirituality, to God, if you believe in God. So it's really about reaching out, and I think that's why it's really important for anyone listening and anyone struggling to know that since alcoholism is so much about isolation, you really can't get better alone. You need to reach out and get help.
Well, we have several callers to talk with. Why don't we do that, we'll take them in the order in which they came in, starting with Aurora, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, this really continues to be a very difficult problem in our world. I wonder, I just turned the program on a few minutes ago. Did you speak to the fact, and I know it isn't emotionally correct to give somebody a guilt problem, but is it ever discussed what the alcohol is going to do to these adult children, when they grow up and be adults?
Absolutely. It's a difficult problem. I did interview many people whose mothers were alcoholic and who were very, very angry. And when we understand alcoholism as, something that's a disease and something that the drinker can't help, it doesn't mean that the drinker isn't accountable and isn't responsible. And really, part of a healing process is it for the alcoholic to hear how she has hurt other people, and for the family of the alcoholic to be educated about alcoholism, to understand that the alcoholic wasn't just trying to hurt people but was trapped in this compulsive cycle. I don't know if that speaks to your question, does it?
Yes, I think it does, because I think if there's anybody listening, maybe this is a thought they hadn't thought of before, because these things that are long range, they're hard to think. It's hard to think about today what will be in the life of your child of 10 to 15, 20 years later.
You mean
it's a very difficult thing when you're dealing with a problem that's a crisis in your own life. How can you think about what you're doing to somebody in the next 10, 15 years from now? You can't think about it. You're only thinking about today and the dilemma you have with your alcoholism.
You know, I would say from my experience in interviewing women for Happy Hours that a lot of people, when they see, say, a mother who's alcoholic, who's drinking, they think she doesn't care, and they think that she doesn't feel guilt or shame. And the truth is very far from that. Usually these women are crippled by their shame, and the pain they feel, the women that I talk to would talk about how their children, one of their children would go down into the basement and just hide, and how her heart just ached for this little boy. And another one talked about how she went into labor after having been drinking for 3 days, and the child took a long time coming because she'd been drunk, and she couldn't even look at her baby when she was born. And I thought, I'll bet the hospital staff thought this woman didn't care about her baby, but she couldn't look at her because she was so crippled by shame. So it's a very complicated problem.
Yes. It truly is. Thank you for writing such a book.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Maybe at this point it'd be good for me to introduce again our guest. Devon Jersild is the author of the book Happy Hours, Alcohol in a Woman's Life, published by Cliff Street, which is a division of HarperCollins. The book should be out in the bookstores if you want to look at it. Questions also are welcome. 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Next, we'll go to Terre Haute in Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hey, did your author do quite a bit of research on the medical aspects of alcoholism? You know, like I was thinking, women have a different set of hormones, right? Yes. Also, their brain operates different than men's. And also, the other thing is, what was there must be a DNA characteristic to people who, you know, become alcoholics. I'd like to have her input on these.
Sure. We did. We talked a little bit at the beginning of the program about the first sort of issue that meant that women do process their bodies process alcohol differently than men, and for that reason, it's a bigger problem. Let's take a minute here, though, to talk about the second question. I think it's interesting because we know that one of the things that puts a person at greater risk for being an alcohol abuser is having parents that were. But in my mind, I guess there's some question about, well, what really is that? Are we talking about something that's a genetic predisposition, or are we talking about a behavior that is learned?
Well, that's a big question. And I think that most scientists feel that there is a genetic component that people that, for instance, one scientist I interviewed who's the head of the Committee on the Genetics of Alcoholism, a major research program, said that he estimated that about 50% of people who are alcoholics are genetically predisposed. But what does that mean, to be genetically predisposed? It doesn't mean that you're fated to become alcoholic, that you have to be. In fact, we don't really know what it means. There are a lot of theories out there, and maybe I can just give you a couple of the more prominent theories of what it means to be or how people might be genetically predisposed. Probably the most prominent theory has to do with predisposition to impulsivity. There's something wrong with a part of the brain that inhibits action when you should inhibit it. So people who are predisposed to behave impulsively are also predisposed to become alcoholic. It's not specific to alcoholism. You're also predisposed to any kind of addiction, to ADD, to depression and anxiety, to all sorts of disorders. So that's one way that people could be predisposed to alcoholism. Really what it is a kind of hyperexcitability of the central nervous system, and alcohol calms it. So, again, David, it's back to this question of self-medication.
Yeah.
Another model is that people who are predisposed to alcoholism are less susceptible to alcohol's effects. They feel them less. So it takes more alcohol to feel a little bit high to accomplish the same thing as someone else. And so, you know, the man or woman who can really hold her liquor might actually be more apt to become alcohol dependent because she has to drink more to feel the same effects. And then there's another model, which is in some ways the reverse of what I've just said, that you might be really susceptible to the positive effects of alcohol. You feel really good when you drink and happy, and the next day you don't have any problem getting up and going off to work or sitting down at your typewriter or whatever it is you're doing because you're not as susceptible to the negative effects, the hangovers. So as you can see, in all of these examples, it's not that you have to become alcoholic. It's an indirect influence that makes you more likely to become alcoholic. I don't want to underestimate the importance of a family history, because people who have a lot of alcoholics in their families, in their extended families, may well, you know, really be predisposed and should really be very, very attentive to their drinking and perhaps choose not to drink at all, because there's no question that family influence is, that family history, whether, as you say, it's behavioral or whether it's, you know, genetic. In some ways, it doesn't matter. You're more apt to become alcoholic, and you need to be careful.
Mm-hmm. We're getting really short on time. I appreciate the questions that the caller asked, and I have one more person I want to try to get in here. In
okay.
Urbana, this is line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Did you address this before? What is the allergy between alcoholism and a medication such as Prozac for depression? Are they incompatible?
You should not be drinking alcohol if you're on Prozac. I'm not a doctor, and I don't want to pretend to be, but I do know that you shouldn't be drinking. If you're prone to depression, alcohol it makes depression worse.
Of course.
Right. So many medications are very dangerous to take in combination with alcohol.
So one really has to have a doctor's careful
Absolutely.
Advice on
you need to talk to your doctor
depression
about
depression medications. Okay, thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
Even aspirin can interact with, or acetaminophen can interact with alcohol, so it's really a good question for anyone to ask their doctor.
That's, important thing. Anytime you get prescription medication, that's one of the things probably you should avoid, but if you're not sure, ask the doctor, ask the pharmacist when you get the medicine.
That's
We're coming down here to a couple of minutes left, and you know, one thing that we really haven't talked very much about is treatment. And unfortunately, it's probably not really enough time for you to do that, but maybe you could say at least a few things. We talked about the fact that because, again, going back to this idea that we have that alcoholics are mostly men, the treatment really is skewed sort of towards men and what will work with them. And one thing that you said was that that some women find it more beneficial to be involved in groups that are all women. Are there some other things that you could say about what sort of treatment seems to be most useful for women?
Well, in the amount of time we have left, I suppose what I would emphasize that if a woman is going for treatment, she should ask, you know, what kinds of special programming do you have for women? Do you have all women's groups? If you've been sexually abused, is there good treatment for that as well? If you're depressed, is there good treatment for that as well? If you have children, you know, what about issues to do with the children? Will someone be helping you with those? If there's domestic abuse, just making sure that there are women's programs at the treatment center where you're going. There are, across the country, a few places that will take women with their children, and interestingly, these have a really high success rate. Many women do very well when they can bring their children into treatment with them. We're still working. There's really a long way to go in terms of really tailoring treatment to women's problems. But there are some places that are more sensitive than others, and it's a really good idea to ask.
Yeah. I think one of the things that struck me as particularly interesting, you know, many people have been helped by Alcoholics Anonymous, and certainly some women have been, but I was really struck by the comment in the book that some women, when they come to AA, find trouble with the very first step, which is the thing that says, I give up control, and that many of these women would already say, look, I feel like I don't have control now. You're telling me now that I have to give up control. Yeah, that's going to work real well for me.
Yeah.
Again, one of those things that suggests that women's experience is different from men's experience, and from the get-go, you got to take a different approach.
That's right. That's right. It's in many ways, it's a question of emphasis, but for a woman to say I'm powerless, as you say, sometimes she shrugs her shoulder and says, so what's new? I have been all my life. And for her, the real revelation is that she can't actually take control, that she can't, not of her drinking. She's not going to be able to control her drinking if she's dependent on alcohol. But to find out that she can take control of her life is far more revelatory for her.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to finish. There's a lot in this book that we haven't touched on, so I certainly would recommend it to anyone who is interested in reading more on this issue. The title is Happy Hours, Alcohol in a Woman's Life by Devon Gerseld. And if you look for the book, her first name, Devon, kind of like it sounds, her last name, Gerseild. And again, the book's published by Cliff Street, Division of HarperCollins. And Ms. Gerseld, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, David. It was a pleasure.